Welcome to the Muscle Expert Podcast with Ben Pakulski, one of the world's top professional bodybuilders, an expert on human performance and mindset mastery. Ben dives deep to deliver the strategies of the top experts to upgrade your body, mind, muscle, strength, performance, biochemistry, and how to become the upgraded modern man. Join us on BenPakulski.com to learn the cutting-edge techniques to take control of your body, your brain, and create your greatest life.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. I'm your host, Ben Pakulski. You are listening to the Muscle Expert Podcast. As always, upgrading the modern man. And to my surprise, many women are becoming loyal listeners as well. And ladies, we appreciate you very much. And I definitely don't want to overlook you guys. But today we've got a guest that everyone can benefit from. Something I'm massively interested in is the idea of treating the body as a whole, making sure that you're taking care of obviously your body, your health, but also your mind. And this gentleman is really becoming a pioneer in the development of products and the development of the conversation around how to optimize the human body and human potential and not have to focus on the disease model of typical allopathic medicine. So he's a surgeon, actually a vascular surgeon. He also owns a academy called the Operian Academy, which I'm really going to dig deep into. The gentleman is the medical director of the Neurohacker Collective, Mr. Daniel Stickler. Welcome, sir.
Hey, great to be here.
Thanks for jumping on with me. And, you know, you guys are obviously doing really, really great things. I've been following your company from a distance for quite a while because I think it seems to be the number one product right now in the nootropic space. And, you know, everybody I talk to absolutely loves the product. But I don't want to dive into the product quite yet. I'm much more interested in the science behind it. I'm much more interested in your contribution to it. My listeners are very science oriented. They want to know about what's going on, why. I mean, you guys have 42 different ingredients in there. So, you know, eventually getting to that, getting into all of it. But most importantly, I'd like to talk about your life. So, you know, I've done a lot of research into you in the last couple of days. You're doing some really, really interesting stuff that all of my listeners would be very interested in. Can you tell us a little bit about, first of all, your history and then about the Operian Academy?
Yeah, I think it's best to just kind of give you a quick overview of where I came from. Yeah. I went into medicine with an idealized concept of what we were going to be doing. You know, it was about improving the quality of life, improving outcomes for people. And I got into it and I realized it was more focused on disease model. And so I looked at what I could do in that regard, and it was kind of limited as far as the pathways, because most primary care and disease model medicine is about delaying or postponing death in some stepwise pattern, not mm-hmm. about increasing, making life better, or helping to achieve greater outcomes. So I went into surgery. I loved working with my hands, and surgery was a nice option to really look at something that I could do that was not so much focused on disease model. And then I went into weight loss surgery. So I did gastric bypass surgery for about 10 years as doing laparoscopic gastric bypass. And I saw that as a way to improve quality of life for people until several years in, and I started to realize that it didn't work very well. And number two, it was not the right way to be treating the human system. I started doing work with Synagenics about 2005. And by 2009, I had decided surgery, especially weight loss surgery, was not something that I wanted to pursue as a passion or anything like that, because it wasn't meeting my vision of improving outcome. And we progressed beyond the Synagenics model because we felt the Synagenics model was kind of limited to nutrition, fitness, and hormones. And there was a much greater piece that was missing from that. So we developed the Operian concept and started working with that, working with genetics, working with all aspects of lifestyle, and had some great outcomes. So we just we ran forward with that model.
I love that you're digging into that. That was one of the most intriguing things that I found when I was researching what you do, is you're really diving deep into epigenetics and the genetic code and how that may be the key to the optimized life, as you call it. So is that what you say is missing from the Synagenics model?
It's part of it. I mean, you know, we also looked at things like sleep. We looked at the environment which you interact in. We looked at mindset and thought processing. We look at stress. We do a deep dive into stress response. And, you know, stress and sleep are probably the two biggest issues that we face as human beings. When we don't have sleep and we don't have stress optimized, our chances of achieving optimal outcomes goes down dramatically. And no matter how hard you work out, how great you eat, you're still not going to have that complete optimization that really makes an amazing difference in your life.
So is the Aperient Academy something where you're going through and doing an educational model? Is it, you know, a certification of sorts, or how does it work?
Well, we have two different branches of what we do. So we have the Aperion Center, which is where I work with my medical clients. I don't want to call them medical necessarily, because it's more lifestyle clients, even though we do medical treatments with them. And then we have the Aperion Academy, which is where we actually train coaches and clinicians in implementing our model of this whole systems approach with genetics and epigenetics as well.
Fascinating. So, you know, I'd love to go down this road. So I know a lot of my listeners are very interested in health optimization. This is something that, as I told you before the call, that I'm very interested in, and I'm kind of turning my life, you know, outside of bodybuilding and going toward just trying to be involved in the conversation of, hey, how can we make men live a better quality life and a longer life? And taking control of their life is, you know, massive. So I'd love to dig into, you know, some maybe things that you're discovering about how guys can upgrade the quality of their life, their sleep, their environment, you know, whatever you find maybe the biggest outlier, the biggest red herring that people are needing to change.
Well, I think the best way to enter into this kind of concept is to understand the systems approach a little
sure.
bit better.
Perfect.
And this plays well into the Qualia product as well, because Qualia utilizes the systems approach. But medicine has been focused on a disease model with intervention and outcome.
Yep.
And unfortunately, the human system is not a complicated system. It's a complex system. And understanding the differences between complicated and complex are important. I mean, you look at you want to create a flying machine, you know, you can create an airplane using complicated intelligence. So you can take a computer, you can take it down to a reductionist aspect and understand what each individual part contributes to the whole. But you can't do that with a bird. A bird is a complex system that you can't utilize complicated intelligence to kind of outline what it does and the potentials. It's just like if you see a don't walk sign. I mean, for you looking at a don't walk sign, you're looking at all aspects of what's going on. So is somebody, you know, is it in the middle of the night and somebody's coming down the street, looks a little scary, you know, are you going to stand there and wait when there's no cars? A complicated intelligence generally doesn't take into account all these different aspects. It doesn't take into account emotions, variabilities, predictabilities in that regard. So you can't use that in the human system. Now, you can't also use just complex intelligence, because our brains can't process the amount of data that's required for us to interact. Like if you came to me as a client and I'm helping you to optimize, I can't just talk to you, use my brain and say, okay, this is what you need to do. You throw all these biometric numbers at me and I can't bring them all together, but we can use a computer to kind of take all the biometric data, give us some kind of trend or overview, a summary of what we're seeing, then plug that into our brain and then basically create an outcome based on using the combination of the complex and complicated intelligence. It's what I call augmented intelligence, using the two. Now, medicine and health in general, I mean, health and wellness even has relied on looking at the human system as a complicated system. And that's where everything kind of went awry. It's not a complicated system. It's a complex system. Just like looking at elevated cholesterol, you know, one, what does it actually mean? What are the outcomes that you see with that? Two, what went into it? Is it environment? Is it the person's finances? Is it their nutrition? Is it their genetics? Is it their stress? Is it their sleep? Well, it's a combination of everything. But you don't take that into account in the current system of medicine and health. You just look at it and say, elevated cholesterol, you're going to be at high risk for heart disease. Here's a statin drug. Then you got to look at what the outcomes of that intervention sure. are going to be. So it's not as easy as medicine is trying to make it. You know, even like medical research. I mean, we look at medical research and we see, okay, well, you know, this drug works really well for this. Well, if you look at the actual data, the drug works really well for about 70% of the population. But, you know, it's applied across the board. You know, here's a treatment for hypertension. Okay, great. So this is what we give to a patient. Well, this patient didn't respond to it. Why? Well, they're in that 30%. They're an individual. And that's where we need to start looking at things is everybody is unique. And we're seeing that in the genetics. I found that in diet and weight loss. You know, I ran a diet program along with the surgical weight loss program. And we had two dietitians, two exercise physiologists, two health psychologists on staff. And yet we couldn't get outcomes as good as we were getting with the people that were in our health optimization program that wasn't a weight loss program, but they were losing weight better because we were addressing the whole system better than what we were doing when we were focused on weight loss.
So can we dive a little bit into this biometric data, like give us an idea of what things you're looking at? So, you know, if our listeners are very curious on how they may treat the body as a whole system, what exactly markers are you looking at?
Well, we look at a variety of markers and it depends on what's available for each person, but we look at comprehensive blood work. So we get about, you know, 10, 12 pages of blood work. And I'm not the kind of, I don't believe in getting all of these toxicity panels and these food allergy panels. You know, those are scare tactics that aren't really that actionable, not as effective in most people. Now, I'll get them if I need to, if I find that I'm at a sticking point. But generally, I'm looking at like hormones. I'm looking at inflammatory markers. I'm looking at genetics. We've got huge genetic panels that we look at for athletic performance, for nutrition, for detoxification and mitochondrial health. We look at sleep genetics. You know, sleep is a really funny thing because we all have a different chronotype. So are you more prone to be a morning or an evening person? Are you mixed? You know, where does it fall? But we try to fit our sleep into our lifestyle rather than fitting our lifestyle around our sleep. And it doesn't work very well that way. So we have this thing called chronic social jet lag, where, you know, somebody who's got a job that they have to be there at 6 a.m., yet they're an evening chronotype, they're going to chronically be off of their bio time, and they're not going to be productive. They're going to feel like crap, brain fog, you know, across the board, because they're not really focusing on their own individual response to different environmental and lifestyles.
Is determining somebody's chronology as simple as a subjective like question and answer, kind of when do you feel best type of scenario?
Well, it's a combination. I mean, you're dealing with we look at the genetics of chronotypes. So we carry certain genes that give us predispositions for different chronotypes. But we also interact with the client because, you know, using just the genes, you're using complicated intelligence. So you've got to still be able to interact, ask questions, you know, is this gene really even expressing? Because we have that epigenetic piece that can control what genes are turned on and off. And they all interact with each other as well. So it's more of an interactive use of all of this biometric data. Now, we're also getting things like we do a psychophysiologic stress profile. So we actually look at your physiologic response in stress situations and how you what your resiliency is. So we'll hook you up to a machine that's measuring skin temperature, skin conductance, heart rate variability, respirations in the abdomen and chest, muscle tension, EEG analysis, expired CO2. And we take you through a variety of stressors, and then we watch what happens during the stressor and how quickly you recover back to baseline, or if you don't, you know, what we can do to help you to do that, because that feedback of the physiology into the brain just amplifies that stress response. So it's more about developing a really strong resiliency pattern for people. So we look at that. We look at QEG brain mapping. So we look at numbers on the wave patterns in the brain. We look at, like I said, the genetics. We do an extensive intake on just a subjective interaction with each client.
So speaking of your stress response, is that typically something you guys find to be mostly a genetic predisposition, or is that a lot of the times, you know, a learned response, or what's been the best, you know, mitigation strategy you guys are using? Because I know there's obviously some genes, that, you know, COMT genes that are going to be influencing stress response and ability to recycle catecholamines. Right. But is that typically what you're looking at, is the genetic expression, or are you looking at just someone's learned helplessness kind of scenario?
Yeah, I mean, learned helplessness is going to shift epigenetically, so it's going to change expressions of the genes. Mm-hmm. What we typically see in the baseline genotype is that we're looking at neurotransmitters for sure. We're also looking at HPA axis genes, but we look at how they interact. So you can look at COMT, but you've also got to take into account like MAOA. You've also got to take into account MTHFR1298C to see how they do with production of neurotransmitters. Mm-hmm. You got to look at the dopamine receptors in the brain, the DRD2s.
How are you looking at that?
Through the genetics. So what we do is we put together an overall picture of how all these genes interact and the probable outcomes. Then we talk to the person and see if their outcomes are consistent with that, or their other biometric data is consistent with that. And then we can, you know, really fine tune to each individual best ways to overcome what they're dealing with. And, you know, we work with a lot of athletes, business executives, entrepreneurs, and it's amazing. That stress piece is probably the highest impact. That and sleep are the highest impact pieces that we have. I mean, to have somebody there, I mean, most people don't realize that, you know, a healthy resting breath rate is about 5 to 8 times a minute. Now, I know this happens every time I give this talk about this, but all your listeners are probably measuring their respiratory rate yeah. right now. But most of us go around breathing 15 to 20 times a minute.
Wow.
And you can't peg on to your heart rate variability at that pace. It's too high. And so you're always going to be off on your heart rate variability, which is going to throw off your sympathetic, parasympathetic balance. Athletes are really focused in on this right now. Special forces soldiers, they train to this to really optimize that response. I mean, you know, what you want to have, stress is not a bad thing. Stress is great. I mean, it in the acute phase, it amplifies things. You know, you're able to get more blood flow to the brain. You're able to get more flow of oxygen into the blood. You're getting more oxygen and nutrients to the muscles. You know, all this stuff is working to amplify the cognitive and physical performance during stress. But you don't want to carry that once that stressful situation's over. So when you walk out of that, it's like the executive that walks into the boardroom. That stress response is valuable. They want that. But when they walk out of the boardroom, they want to get down to that, you know, Hindu cow calm state of baseline.
Sure.
And that's what we train with resiliency.
Brilliant. So how much of a population are you guys typically working with? Because it seems as though we're so new to looking at genetics and epigenetic expression that to really look at a population and make findings based on their DNA predispositions is very obscure. There's so many interactions that we're unaware of, or at least that I'm unaware of. So is this something that's just like trial and error, that you're trying to make correlations between their learned or their expressed response to you and the DNA expression they're showing?
Well, unfortunately, right now, we don't have that exact of a science on the epigenetics. One of our instructors is she teaches epigenetics at Stanford, mm-hmm. and we're working with her to develop some metrics. We're developing a biometric platform that incorporates everything that we can start looking at these relationships. But I've done genetic reviews on over 2,000 people, and most of our panels, we created our own panels so that we understand which ones have high impact, which ones are low, despite, you know, some research will say have really strong outcomes with a certain gene type, but we don't see it in the clinical practice. And then other studies will show that this gene really is very minor, but we see it as a major impact when we're working with clients. So most of our data has been collected so far in an anecdotal basis. And that's why we're building the biometric platform that we can funnel it all into. And then we looked at it and we said, you know, with the Apeiron Center, we can impact, you know, several hundred people. If we can train the coaches and the clinicians in doing this model, we can affect hundreds of thousands of people with mm-hmm. this model, because we want to shift the paradigm of medicine. I mean, of health and medicine. We don't want to just make this available for a small number of people and think that we're changing the world. You know, my goal is to introduce this paradigm and Apeiron's paradigm to the masses so that we can get it out there and use it. And, you know, in the genetic world right now, all these direct-to-consumer tests that you can get online, I mean, they don't work very well. I mean, how many times have you talked to somebody and said it didn't look like me at all? Well, it's because you can't use genetics in that way. Genetics is so – there's such a network of interactions. There's such an impact of environment and lifestyle. I mean, you exercise for 6 months, you're shifting the expression of 7,000 genes. Now, that's not changing the code. You still have the same code, but you're changing the expression of 7,000 genes. You meditate for 8 weeks and you're going to change the expression of 3,500 genes. Mm-hmm. So you turn some on, you turn some off, but we don't have a way to directly measure that right now. They're working on it.
Yeah, that was my question is, you know, these numbers are – you know, sound pretty concrete, but are they in fact pretty speculative? And, you know, maybe it's a type of thing where, okay, we see this person's done this. So correlatively, we see these correlations.
Right. And that's why you've got to interact with the people, because we don't have that direct test that tells us, you know, they're working on that now. I mean, they're working on Dr. Aronica, our other instructor. She does research on weight loss and epigenetics at Stanford. So she's looking at epigenetic marks that have to do with outcomes. But epigenetic marks, you know, you don't have that in your genetics. Your genetics is just basically the hardware, and the epigenetics is that software overlying it and what's actually being expressed. So that interaction right now is our best way to do that. So we know the right questions to ask, you know, just like, you know, every direct-to-consumer test gets the ACTN3 to determine whether you are a power athlete, a mixed athlete, or an endurance.
Right.
I mean, it's ridiculous because we know that when you're an endurance, if you're I think it's a TT is the endurance athlete on ACTN3. Mm-hmm. Well, we know that in the body, ACTN2 gets upregulated significantly in a TT that exercises. And that's why you see sprint athletes in the Olympics that actually carry a TT.
Right.
So to give somebody a report that says, oh, you're an endurance athlete and that's it, is a bit silly.
It's kind of the irony that I always make the joke. I got all those tests back and it literally said that I was meant to be a long distance runner. I'm like 100% endurance athlete. Like literally no predisposition to building muscle whatsoever. And I'm walking around 300 pounds with an 8-pack, right? Expression is everything. I started training when I was very young and my body shifted. And now since I've left bodybuilding, I have to reverse those genetics. Like I'm trying to get that endurance expression back because I'm trying to lose muscle. And it's, you know, trying to almost think and eat and train like I would if I was actually an endurance athlete. It's very very new territory for me.
Well, and you can look at it, and you know, we look at about 45 genes when it comes to strength and hypertrophy. Mm-hmm. And we actually divide the two pieces up, and then when we look at endurance versus power, we're looking at about 40 different genetic variants in there. But the goal is not to tell you what you're good or not good at. The goal is to actually look at what we can change expression of mm-hmm. through lifestyle. You know, if you're somebody who says, you know, I just run out of gas in anything I do, and we look and you've got an AMP-D1 deficiency, then we know we can work with that. We can work with mitochondrial upregulation. We can work with D-ribose works really well in that group. So I have athletes that say, you know, I'm on a hill sprint and about midway up the hill, I just run out of gas. I've got great heart lung capacity, but I can't drive that final drive up the hill. So we put D-ribose in their water and they're drinking the water on the ride, and they are able to maintain that energy turnover through the hill climb. And it doesn't work for everybody, but at least it gives us a direction to say, okay, we're seeing something here that's consistent with what you're reporting. So let's try this, because this would be very directed at this outcome.
So my listeners understand gene expression. Would that be the type of thing, Dr. Sickler, where someone could do for a short amount of time and then it would naturally get better? Or would it be the type of thing, hey, you know, you're gonna have to use this mediation strategy for the rest of your life?
In some things it's like that, and in other things it's not, because you know, gene expression, we have some gene expressions, like in epigenetics, we have what we call epigenetic marks that are written in pen and epigenetic marks written in pencil. So lifestyle things are things that we can change that are written in pencil. So we can erase and turn them on, turn them off. Like ACTN3 is an actual you know, it's a break in the gene itself. So it's not a full gene. So you're not going to produce that. So are we able to upregulate that? No, that's not going to happen. But most other genes we can. Like the FTO gene, you know, everybody, they get worried because they have the fat gene, you know, they've got this variant. But we know that if you exercise, there is zero expression of that gene. So for chronic exercisers, just because you carry an FTO-AA doesn't mean that you're going to be obese. Mm-hmm. It's just a propensity for that if your lifestyle isn't matching to it. I mean, you know, people talk about MTHFR and APOE, and they talk about it as a mutation, and they're not mutations. Those are people that don't fully understand genetics, because these are allele variants. These are variants that occurred because they were trying to adapt to an environment that the person lived in. Just like digesting milk, if you have a lactase deficiency, which is the most common thing, then that's the normal variant. But the Northern Europeans, they moved into a colder environment. They domesticated animals. They were able to drink milk. There were famines. There was a survival benefit for being able to keep that lactase turned on. And so now we see all of these North American descendants that carry the ability to digest lactose as adults. And the same thing with APOE. I mean, APOE originated in more of an African haplotype population, and it protects them against pathogenic organisms. But, you know, for us here in a more Western culture, we're not exposed to that, but we are exposed to high saturated fat, which is not a benefit of that gene. And so when I see an APOE4, you know, I tend to focus dietary patterns on lower saturated fat intake. But it's a matter of adapting your lifestyle to match your genes and get the best expression out of them.
So it sounds as though where this is headed is the type of thing where if there's an athlete, if there's a high performer that's able to maybe objectively look at their life and look at the way they react to scenarios, look at the way they train, look at their limitations in every aspect of life, and maybe document those, that they could perhaps look at a gene that's correlated with, you know, a stress response, with, like you say, endurance, with maybe a weakness in certain ability athletically. And then, you know, make a list of those and then go, okay, what do those correlate with as far as genetic DNA code goes? And then perhaps be able to change the expression?
Right. And that's the complicated intelligence. You know, we our brains won't digest all of that information and be able to correlate or see relationships and correlations. So, you know, we can, you know, I wear the bio strap, so I'm getting, you know, heart rate, respiratory rate, oxygen saturation, heart rate variability, and it loads up into my platform. The platform we're developing actually links all of this data, so you can have over 70 different biometric devices that feed into this. Then you upload your labs, you upload your genetics, and you upload your supplements, and we can actually look at what's happening in relationships there. But that's the computer that's going to do that. Then when we start seeing a commonality of these relationships, then we can start associating that with the symptoms that people are expressing. But for right now, we're in this era of big data, and that's where all this information is going to really come from.
So my biggest area of interest now that I've exited, you know, the pure desire to put on as much muscle tissue as possible, now I've kind of shifted into how can we make the brain optimal? How can we make the brain function optimally? How can we recover? So I'd like to shift the conversation there and talk about genetic expression there, because it seems like that there can be a massive influence on particular genes, on how your neurotransmitters function on many, many levels. So I'd love to shift the conversation there and have a look at exactly what you're looking at, which genes are being expressed in certain ways, and how maybe we could mitigate certain things in that realm.
Yeah, the brain is definitely a high impact area for us. And like I said, you know, we look at a QEEG analysis on each of our clients. We look at the psychophysiologic stress profile. So we're looking at that HPA axis, and then we look at the genetics on top of that. All of these interactions are really important because you can't isolate one. You know, we've always done that. We've always taken these supplements and these prescriptions that are designed to create a certain outcome. And yet what it's looking at is, oh, I want to have better focus and concentration. Well, you take this and it's great because you're actually creating greater attention and focus, but what are you sacrificing in response to that? Mm-hmm. And that's what we're seeing, you know, even with the TDCS, the transcranial direct current stimulation, you know, everybody likes to quote that DARPA study with the snipers and how they accelerated learning, their learning curve when they were doing the TDCS. Mm-hmm. But what they don't pay attention to is the fact that their automaticity went down dramatically in that group. So you're enhancing one area, but it's sacrificing another. And this is the systems-based approach. You want to look at how all these systems interact and how that outcome can be created through that. And so we look at the neurotransmitters. We look at supplements that are designed to enhance different areas. But again, you can't look at just one specific neurotransmitter and say, oh, well, you're going to have low dopamine. Well, you may not. You know, we got to look at how that dopamine's broken down. We got to look at the receptors that you have there. And still, yet, we have to see if you're expressing what we're seeing in the biometric data.
That's my biggest question. Is there so much subjectivity surrounding the testing mechanisms? Like, what are we doing to test dopamine receptors? What are we doing to test dopamine levels in the brain? I know there's been some urine analysis that have been done, you know, perhaps blood, perhaps, you know, you tell me. I mean, what's the most cutting edge testing methodology you guys are using?
We don't.
Yeah.
we have tried many, many things to assess neurotransmitter status, worked with several companies. And, you know, it's just most of our neurotransmitters are made in the peripheral tissue. So if you're looking at urinary, which is where everybody looks, you've got to figure out which of those are coming from the brain. And it doesn't work that way. I mean, most things don't cross the blood-brain barrier very well.
Right.
So I have gotten completely away from trying to assess the status. It's more of a probability basis. So when we correlate the data and we see brainwave patterning that's consistent with something, we see the genetics consistent with something and the symptoms consistent with that, then we've got a pattern there. We're seeing that, okay, this is working this way. But then you look at an intervention. Okay, so we have somebody who has great dopamine receptors. They have their COMT is kind of a heterozygous and not too bad. They should have pretty decent dopamine in the brain. But then their MTHFR1298C or their tyrosine hydroxylase genes are showing significant reductions in production of dopamine. Mm-hmm. Okay, so what do you do there? Well, we would say, well, let's try something like Mucuna, which has L-DOPA in it, and see if it works. Well, that's the key, is the reassessment. So when you do an intervention, you always want to have some form of biometric to do the assessment of whether it's working. Because subjectively, I mean, you're going to get a placebo response in a lot of people to say, oh, well, this is working or this is not, from a subjective analysis. Right. So you want to try to focus more on objective data. And, you know, this platform we're working with is going to incorporate that, and you can actually set up the biohacks with it. So you can say, okay, for the next month, I'm going to take this supplement and I want to see what's happening with my stress and my sleep. So it's assessing, it's looking at all your biometric data. It's looking at your subjective response. You know, it'll ask you periodically, how'd you sleep last night? What's your stress level today? And then at the end of the month, it looks at beginning and end. And it will tell you, okay, your stress, reported stress went down 30%, your sleep improved by 10%, but your energy level dropped by 30%. Mm-hmm. So you can look at all of it together and say, ah, okay, so this isn't quite the on target with what I'm trying to achieve, or it is. And that's where things are going in this biohacker world, which is really amazing and awesome.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, especially around dopamine. I mean, ultimately, you can give someone a Mucuna and see perhaps something, but unless you're doing it over, you know, a 30-day, a 60-day period, are they going to get some type of upregulation and then maybe a downregulation and a decrease in looking at perhaps their perceived motivation, their perceived neural drive or whatever it is, maybe over a long period may actually upgrade. Very, very fascinating way to look at it. Are you looking at the other neurotransmitters? Because I'm not honestly familiar with the genes that are correlated with maybe serotonin production or acetylcholine or even GABA. So,
we look at certain ones that are associated with GABA. We look at ones that are associated with melatonin. We look at ones that that work with norepinephrine and norepinephrine breakdown. We look at ones that are associated more with serotonin receptors than we are with production. But you've still got your tyrosine hydroxylase, you've got your MTHFR 1298Cs.
Sure.
Those are pretty high impact ones. But again, we correlate that. Like we had a woman a couple weeks ago that, you know, all of her data on her appetite and satiety looked pretty strong, you know, strong dopamine. The one thing we didn't have in there was the 1298C on the MTHFR, but she had really excellent everything. And she told us that somebody told her one time that she had dopamine receptor problems, but, you know, we looked and her genetics showed probably pretty good on dopamine receptors. But she was homozygous for 1298C on MTHFR, so she's got a 30% probability reduction in production of dopamine. So we put her on Mucuna, and within a week, she said it's the first time in her life that she hasn't been just voraciously hungry all the time. And so it was working. So we were seeing a subjective response that was consistent with what we were working towards.
Right.
You know, if she had said, I'm still hungry, it's not working, you know, after about a month of that, then we would step back and look at other possibilities there. But that was our highest, you know, when you hear hoofbeats, you don't think of zebras. And so we went for the Mucuna to begin with, and we had a great response from it.
Fascinating. So is this how you guys are making correlations with the development of qualia? So first question, I guess, how involved were you with the development of qualia, or are you just more involved with the development of their future products and what they're doing going forward?
Well, it's interesting how I got involved with qualia. I, you know, we've been using cognitive enhancers in our practice for quite a while. I mean, we've used, you know, like Cognizine and Onnit and Siltep and all of those. And generally, we saw about a 50-50 response. So about half the people would report subjectively, hey, this is doing really well for me. And then half would say, I'm just not really experiencing anything with it. And a client of mine asked me about qualia back about October of last year, November. And I said, well, I looked at the product. I said, it looks pretty darn good. Cause I've been big into nootropics. I created a nootropics course on Udemy, and I had been developing a nootropics powder, but I couldn't get it flavored because of all the mushroom extracts in it. So I abandoned that. But then qualia had a lot of what I was developing, and I was like, wow, this seems like a pretty balanced product. And then I looked at it, and they had adaptogens and, you know, neuro antioxidants and neurotransmitter boosters and, you know, just a lot of vascular dilation supplements that worked really well together. And what happened is I started recommending it to other clients. I still hadn't taken it at this point. And I was getting about a 90 to 95% positive report with it. And it wasn't like it was taking 30 days to see something. These were people reporting within the first couple of days of taking it that they were getting amazing outcomes with it. And I thought, okay, well, this is interesting stuff. I want to talk to them about it. So I contacted NeuroHacker and I said, I want to talk to somebody that was involved in the development of the product because I run a podcast. And so I got on a call with Daniel Schmachtenberger, who's the co-founder and head of R&D. He's actually developed the whole product and was fascinated by the way they took the approach. They took the whole systems-based approach, which is what we had been doing. And nobody had done that in the nootropics world. And so we had a great interview, and then a couple weeks later, he called me up and he said, we need a medical director here at NeuroHacker. Would you be interested? And I said, absolutely. So I started studying the product, started looking at the things a little bit more in depth than I had. I'm involved in the development of some of the new products that are coming out. But you know, the thing we saw, and we did our own little pilot study here with doing QEG brain mapping. We looked at before, and we looked at 4 hours after the first dose or after the full dose. We also looked at psychophysiologic stress profiles before and at 30 days. We looked at another cue at 30 days, and we looked at cognitive performance, so memory, reaction time, executive function at the beginning and at 30 days. It blew us away with what we were seeing. I mean, we only did a small study with 9 people. It wasn't controlled or anything like that. We just wanted to see what might be happening. And the QEEG analysis blew us away at 4 hours alone. I mean, at 4 hours, we were seeing, I mean, I have this really high alpha pattern in my frontal lobes. It's my functional ADD. But in taking Qualia, I'd always noticed that I really was able to focus well. And, you know, I've tried other things like modafinil and things like that, phenylparacetams and all of that to see if I could do it. But nothing worked as well as the Qualia did. Mm. And sure enough, on my QEG, my frontal alpha had normalized in these areas. We also had people with high beta activity, indicative of anxiety and nervousness. And that came down, and they reported subjectively improvements in those areas. So we saw a really nice trend, and we're in the process of developing a larger double-blinded randomized trial.
So before we move into the ingredients and the formulation in Qualia, you mentioned some ingredients that you saw benefiting cognitive function. And I'm curious as to, you said you work with some pro athletes, if you saw any specific ones that maybe had a greater correlation with or perhaps a better incidence with success for cognitive function, neurodrive, focus, anything like that, just the standalone ingredients in your practice prior to Qualia?
I did. I have to be careful here because this is
maybe ingredients rather than products.
Yeah. Well, studies show that phenylparacetam works really well for athletes. And, you know, again, it's a research chemical. It's not something I'm recommending anybody to take, but there's some pretty solid data on that. There's also solid data on some modafinil, in some of the European trials. And that's why modafinil and phenylparacetam are actually banned by WADA. Ah. They don't want that performance enhancement piece there. Now, you know, one of the things that I found really beneficial that is permitted is it's the what's the supplement called? I'm trying to think of it. It's the beta hydroxy beta methylbutyrate, the HMB.
Just like exogenous ketones?
Well, the HMB supplementation itself, yeah. Hmm. There was a pretty big study by Wilson that was done. Yeah. And, you know, they showed with controls versus the athletes, they did like deadlift, bench press, and squat. And they found versus the controls, the ones on the HMB had greater hypertrophy. And in total, on the three different exercises, in 12 weeks, the ones on the HMB had actually achieved 100-pound increase.
Sure. Specific to hypertrophy, but nothing specific to brain function, focus, and output neurologically?
No. Now, one thing I do find that works really well for the brain is holy basil, Tulsi. Hmm. Tulsi, what it does is it goes into the muscle and it increases growth hormone release locally in the muscle, but it also causes the gene expression of FNDC5. FNDC5 goes to the liver, it gets converted to irisin, which goes to the brain and upregulates BDNF in the brain. Hmm. So you're getting better memory and learning and neuroplasticity components with the BDNF increases.
So you mentioned phenylparacetam, modafinil. Personally and experientially with clients, I've seen some positive effect. I've also seen some negative effect. Mm-hmm. Anything that you can speak to as far as what people may see as potential downsides of these things?
Yeah, I mean, it's very subjective in this regard. Now, we can look at genetics and say, you know, with COMT, you know, somebody on modafinil or phenylparacetam, they tend not to respond very well to if they're an AA on COMT, whereas the GGs tend to get the best response in that, and the AGs are somewhere in between. But that's just a generalization too. I've seen some people with AAs that responded extremely well to modafinil or to phenylparacetam. So it's a, you know, it's a lot right now. We can give guidance based on genetics and things like that, but it's more of trial and error with these things, even with things like choline. I mean, you have some people that have choline sensitivities that, you know, choline's a requirement of the body, but some people can't deal with just slightly elevated levels of choline in the blood. you see that with all the nootropics though, and that's really.
When you say can't deal, what are they experiencing?
They experience heart palpitations. They experience sweating. They can't control their heat very well. But that's just one of the things I've seen with the especially with the alpha GPC at higher doses. The other thing is some people can take choline and not really get any response at all from it. But you add a little bit of uridine to it and it can cross the blood brain barrier. And all of a sudden they're saying, oh, my brain fog's gone. I'm thinking better. And aspects of that combination of the two like that.
So is that what impressed you so much about the Qualia? Obviously, so 42 ingredients, the argument that we see all the time is they basically just threw everything in there and with, you know, they're kind of, you know, closing their eyes and throwing it all against the wall. Obviously, from your experience, that isn't the case.
I wish it were that easy,
sure.
You know, because I'm having to go through all this stuff and actually learn all these interactions. But Daniel had actually looked at all 42 ingredients and he looked at how each interacted with each other. Because I would ask him, I would say, well, the studies show that this works better at a higher dose. He said, yeah, but we've got this over here that's going to boost this pathway. And so we don't want to overdo it. So what it's doing, Qualia has this ability to bring the brain into homeostasis, which is the coolest aspect of it. It's not a matter of enhancing this over here and you know, suppressing this over here. What it does is it seems to bring the brain into that balanced homeostatic state. It's almost like a complete adaptogen for the brain. So it's working on the HPA axis. It's working on the neurotransmitters. It's working on all the precursor molecules. It's just amazing. And when I talked to him about it, I'm like, well, why did you add this? And he said, well, this interacts with this one and this one over here. And he has all the data on it. And so, you know, we were doing a kind of a mitigation thing with centrophenoxine because some people were concerned about teratogenic effects. And next thing I know, Daniel's got like 108 articles for us to review. And we review all these articles and we come up with the response to this, which was, Centra is not anything to be concerned about even. But, you know, Daniel knew exactly where to go with this stuff. You know, he relies on me in regards to how this works medically. You know, how does this work in the clinical model? He's the biochemist. He's the guy that really understands these intricate interactions to a degree that I've never seen. And, you know, I've spent a lot of time doing this. I was a neuroscience major undergraduate and I've had a strong focus in the neurochemistry for a long time. But I can tell you, I mean, he's brilliant at this stuff.
So from your perspective, which one is going to have the greater, you know, in your bio, you mentioned how the DNA is going to have the greatest influence. It's going to kind of be the governing body. Do you think DNA has a greater influence on someone's phenotype, or would hormone manipulation have a greater influence on someone's phenotype, or would it be hard to kind of measure? You know, basically, what I'm asking is which one would be your baseline method of entry as far as treatment?
Well, and that is a complicated question in a sense, because I do hormone therapies in my clients. Here's the deal. I have a philosophy that aging is not a natural process. It is a programmed process in our genetics. We don't age because of gradual deterioration. We age because we're programmed to age, kind of the Red Queen hypothesis of evolutionary biology. But survival and adaptation requires a turnover of the population. And so we have these programs in our DNA that they're identifying now that actually tell us, okay, let's not do as good a surveillance on DNA damage anymore. Let's let this process deteriorate. Let's let the hormones kind of step back. These are built into our genetic code. And, you know, this is where aging research is going, is it's going into how do we alter the expressions of these. And it's not the genes themselves. It's the junk DNA, the microRNA expressions and the non-coding RNA segments that are causing a lot of these programs to be initiated. So this stuff that we thought was junk is actually built in there to program this stuff. And hormonal deterioration is a big part of aging, and hormones have a huge impact on gene expression. So when we start losing estrogen and we start losing testosterone and progesterone and thyroid hormones, these all have a huge impact on gene expression. So we're actually seeing this program piece of deterioration and aging. Now, deterioration does play a role in it, but as biologic organisms, we have the ability to replace every cell that we have. You know, it's not a matter of, okay, well, you know, this cell's inactive anymore. We can't even get rid of some of these inactive cells, these senescent cells. Mm-hmm. So there's researchers developing ways to program these to actually die and actually get rid of them so that we can replace with healthier cells. But you know, it's not one thing. It's not going to be, okay, well, hormone replacement is the best way to go. No, it's a matter of, you know, how do we adjust the lifestyle to optimize genetic expression? How do we, here's the way I look at it. I look at everything as an input into a system. So we're the system, and what are the inputs into that system? So we have, you know, our environment, our movement, our thought processing, our nutrition, our exercise, our supplementation, our medications, they're all just inputs. And we have to look at it from a systems-based approach and say, okay, what is that input doing as far as an outcome is concerned? How are we going to create that?
Right. So the reason I asked the question is that I'm sure a lot of my listeners are very curious about hormone replacement, and a lot of them are on the fence about it. A lot of them are doing it. And a lot of them are looking for ways to, quote unquote, biohack their testosterone, biohack their hormone levels, biohack their life. So I'm wondering if, you know, hormone replacement is an inevitability, or it's just an option, or, and if, you know, potentially, quote unquote, biohacking your life is actually an opportunity to upgrade your HPA axis, like you said, perhaps Qualia is doing. That's kind of where the question was going.
Okay. Well, the best way to answer that then is to say that I don't see anything right now from a lifestyle component that's going to boost testosterone in a significant way. Minor improvements in it. My biggest concern now is that we're seeing testosterone deficiencies in late teens, early 20s in a lot of males. And
what's the best way to prevent that?
Well, we don't know. I mean, these are kids that even grew up in a very healthy environment, other than some, you know, organotoxins in the environment, but ate very healthy, exercised regularly, were athletes in school. And yet we're still seeing these deficiencies in that group. So it's occurring at a much younger age. I don't see right now options for inputs into the system other than the actual hormones themselves to boost the response.
So from your perspective, hormone manipulation should be a component of anyone's life who's looking to live a long life?
It's a healthy part of the aging process, and just doing it from a complete systems approach, though.
Not just one.
You have people – I have people come in here that are business executives and say, I've lost my edge. My testosterone's low. Give me testosterone so I can get it back.
Right.
It doesn't work that way.
Right. So speaking to that then, which is there a core group that you think people need to go have tested? So my guys are sitting there and go, you know, you got to tell me what I need to check other than testosterone. Because you understand, we don't all have access to someone as bright as yourself. Most of us are just going to our GP and going, hey, man, I need a hormone profile. They get back free testosterone. They get back estradiol. They go, okay, well, this is low. So your doctor just goes, here, take testosterone, leave me alone. Because he wants to get you out of the office, which obviously I think is negligent, but that's the reality is these guys don't have brilliant minds and have access to it. So what tests do they want to be asking for? And is there a resource that lets them know what the ideal level is? Because GP is going to put you somewhere in the middle of normal. And I know that is so skewed. So I'm curious if there's a resource out there other than the Aperion website I don't even know if you guys even have a resource on there, but is there a way that people know where they should be? And do you have an opinion on what an optimal range is?
I focus on really what their response is and what their free testosterone really is. I see so many people, sex hormone binding globulin, it can just be off the chart in people, and we don't know why. I mean, we look at all these possibilities as to why this is occurring, but I don't have a good answer. Now, I know females on oral estrogens, any form of oral estrogen, they're going to have hugely elevated sex hormone binding globulin. I mean, they have no free available testosterone. It's just gone. But I focus on free testosterone more so than anything else. And, you know, I'm kind of aggressive with it. I'm looking at somewhere in that 18 to 35 range on free testosterone and nanograms. So, I just judge response. So I have some people that respond really well at, you know, 18, 19, but then I have other people that really require to get above 30 in order to get that positive response. And again, that's looking at the biometrics. So we look at a DEXA scan, you know, we're looking at muscle mass, we're looking at body composition, we're looking at their subjective stress responses. So we're looking at all of these different things to determine, is this an ideal range for them or not? And that's important because we can't really establish a normal range, because I've seen people with, you know, total testosterones that they did great at 600. They had enough free testosterone, but then I've had others that had to get up to about 1600 to achieve normal, healthy levels of free testosterone and equal an ideal outcome. So I look at those. I always look at estrogen as well. And, you know, we've been getting overly aggressive with estrogen reductions with the estrogen blockers. And I tell you, I have stepped back from that. You know, if they get above 60, yeah, it's a big deal. But, you know, in that 40 to 60 range, I used to treat all of those, and I don't do that anymore. That range, we're seeing such a potent epigenetic response to estrogen. I mean, the brain, when testosterone crosses the brain, a big part of it is converted into estrogen. So that estrogen in the brain is what gives us the benefits of testosterone on cognitive function. You know, we know stress reduction, we know increased focus, we know better learning, all this from testosterone, but it's not the testosterone, it's that conversion into estrogen as it crosses the blood-brain barrier. And when we start giving all of these, you know, the Arimidex and the anastrozoles and all of that, we start dumping that estrogen level down to a level that's not going to be beneficial. And estrogen truly is, of all the hormones, the most it has the most epigenetic changes associated with it.
So, Doc, I want to get my test levels up. Is it just as simple as taking more tests, or is there something that can perhaps influence sex hormone binding globulin? Is there, you know, a step before testosterone that maybe I wanted to get involved with, whether it be DHEA or progesterone for women? You tell me.
Well, first of all, you got to make sure that all your lifestyle is ideal in that regard. So if you're not sleeping, I mean, yeah, I mean, the only way you're going to get your testosterone up is to take extra doses of it. But if you can get sleeping, you can help buffer that sex hormone binding globulin. If you get your stress down, you know, you can build up. One of the other things that people don't understand is that cortisol actually impairs testosterone's actions. Hmm. So they found this in leadership studies that the best leaders have the highest testosterone and the lowest cortisol. But high testosterone, high cortisol, they would tend to be middle managers. And low testosterone, high cortisol, they tended to be bottom of the pyramid of the business world. So you've also got to mitigate that cortisol, because I could have somebody and they could be hitting these high levels on testosterone. They're like, I'm not getting any response. Well, you look at their cortisol and they're through the roof on the cortisol. So it's not a matter of just looking at that individual number and outcome. You've got to look at all of it. You've got to look at the response as well. And that's why when you do anything, you always want to set out benchmarks or set out metrics that you can measure to say, is this working or is this not, from a more objective standpoint, rather than saying, hey, yeah, I feel better, or I'm gaining muscle mass, you know, whatever. It's not the best way to measure outcomes.
Some other, obviously sleep is a big component. I'd actually love to dig into your sleep routine, but not quite yet. Some other perhaps biohacking mitigation strategies for improving lifestyle. So how much are you paying attention to things like bad light? What does your diet look like? I'm very curious to what maybe what yours is and what you suggest to your patients, because obviously you're considering extending your life as much as possible. So let's start there.
Well, the first thing is nutrition. And what we have found from all the genetic research that we've done is that the closest you can get to a perfect human diet across the board is the Mediterranean diet. It's no question. And I used to be, I mean, I was paleodoc.com for a while, so I was a big paleo guy. But genetics kind of opened my eyes to the reality of the way people respond to different things and the epigenetic responses. So what we look at is we look at setting a base of Mediterranean. Then we tell people, well, you can have higher saturated fat, or you can have higher carbs or lower carbs, or, you know, avoid glutamic acid sources, or, you know, we just fine tune around that Mediterranean diet. The other thing we found is that, you know, I have shifted to keeping saturated fat as low as possible, less than 10% of the diet across the board. Even if they have normal ApoEs and PPAR gammas, you know, I'm still recommending that. And you can do ketogenic without eating saturated fats. I lean people towards omega-3s and monos, the monounsaturated fats. If you want to live a long, healthy life, drink like a half to a full liter of olive oil a week. I mean, that is the nectar of the gods. That's the stuff that epigenetically shifts the expressions of genes in such a positive way. And omega-3s are the same way. So, you know, a fish and eggs are my primary proteins. A lot of olive oil. I mean, tons of olive oil. And, you know, I do a little bit of butter, and I have red meat, maybe two servings a week of red meat, so I don't deprive myself of it. My wife, on the other hand, she has an ApoE4 variant, so she has to really minimize the saturated fats even a little bit more so than I do.
So what negative effect would she get from the ApoE4 variant?
Well, there's a probability that you're going to get increased inflammation, especially the glial cells in the brain. So that's why ApoE4 is associated with a significantly higher risk of Alzheimer's disease. Now, she's got the 3-4 variant, so she doesn't have the real full bore 4-4. And in the 4-4 variant, I mean, they're looking at 30 times standard risk for Alzheimer's disease if you're eating a high saturated fat diet, or, you know, not minimizing that saturated fat. 3-4 significant drop in that risk, but it's still higher than average. So, you know, we try to focus in eating for our genes. I mean, this is nutrigenetics. You look at the genetics that you have that have developed for an environment that you're not living in. So you have to adjust your environment to really get optimal response from it. So we do that with nutrition. And what was the other part of that question?
Anything else that you would suggest people you do as lifestyle interventions? Oh,
yeah, so if we do a full sleep hygiene. So the biggest thing is getting to bed at the same time as frequently as possible. You know, we're messing ourselves up pretty bad by going to bed at 10 o'clock one night, midnight another night, you know, 11 o'clock the next night. So I try to set a normal routine for going to bed. I don't use alarms. Alarms are number one, you know, it just wakes you up out of the wrong phase of sleep. Mm-hmm. Two, if you hit snooze, you set the mindset of I have no willpower. That's the mindset of your day that you begin with. So I don't use alarm clocks, and I try to match chronotypes. So if I see genetically that somebody has a propensity for a specific chronotype, I try to match them on that. We have blue light mitigation that we focus on, you know, blackout curtains at night. We keep the room cool. We keep the electronics out of the room, and really just focus on other genetic pieces to optimize the sleep process. But it's amazing in 30 days of just following a hygiene routine how quickly you can get into, I mean, people that hadn't slept in years. I have one guy, 70 years old, who when he started with me, we ran his genetics before we did anything else. You know, we hadn't even started hormone therapies or anything like that. But at 70 years old, I found in his genetics that he was a very slow metabolizer of caffeine, and he was drinking like 5 cups a day, hadn't slept well in like 50 years. And he actually gave up caffeine at 70 years old. And at the end of the first month, he called me and he said, you know, if that was the only thing that we did in our time together, he said it was worth the money.
Wonderful.
Yeah. So, you know, you look at these things that just don't make sense. And you go, why did we miss this? Why was this not something that was on our radar to begin with?
So is this a service you provide regularly for people? Like if one of my listeners wanted to have you interpret their DNA or become a client at Apeirin?
Yeah, we have clients from 35 states and a dozen foreign countries that come to see us. So we set up an intake. It's a 2-day long intake, so it's 16 hours where we run a lot of biometric testing. You sit down with me for about 4 hours one-on-one. And then I work with the clients through video calls once a month for 30 minutes every month. So we look at where they are, where they're going, you know, what they've achieved, what didn't work, and assess that. We also have a program that's designed more around just health and wellness coaching. So we have these trained coaches that have come through the Apeiron Academy that understand the genetics and the lifestyle coaching that we do. I mean, you know, I see myself as more of a coach than a doctor. I mean, it's no longer in the realm of medical care that you can't be a coach. You've got to interact with a person. And it's not that I'm a dictator of health outcomes. If somebody says, you know what, I really don't want to take that medication, I'm like, oh, great. Okay, let's find an alternative here. Mm-hmm. I'm not telling somebody to do something, which is where most medicine has been. It's more of a partnership with each client when we work together.
Great. And how extensively are you teaching this stuff in the Apeiron Academy? We briefly touched on it at the beginning, but is it literally a module-based thing where maybe one of my listeners could become a coach for you?
Yeah, we have physicians, chiropractors, dietitians, health coaches, all in there. We actually have a couple of people taking the course. That I have one guy who's an investment banker that's just a biohacker wanted to learn it, but it's 120 hours of online training. We do a lot of interactive with it, but we teach you the genetics. Most people do their own genetic interpretation during the course. Mm-hmm. You know, we have templates that are really easy to use, and only our certified coaches get access to them because, you know, you shouldn't be reading this stuff if you don't fully understand genetics.
That's one of the biggest limitations right now is there's some, like you said, some companies out there giving you these interpretations that are so vague and inaccurate. There's really nobody out there who's a good resource that I found yet to give you kind of all the pieces put together, you know, as best as possible. So I'm sure you're going to be getting a lot of emails and calls about this because I know my listeners are very curious. We get so many questions and we have people on about DNA testing. So do you just recommend doing like a 23andMe and then sending over your data to you?
Yeah, we use 23andMe data. I mean, there's 900,000 genetic variants on the back end of 23andMe. And the only downside of 23andMe is it takes, 4 to 6 weeks to get your results back. Mm-hmm. But our coaches, if somebody opts for a coach, and our coaches work distantly, so we have coaches in just about every state right now too, but they work through virtual calls and they implement our entire lifestyle program at a much cheaper rate than what I charge. But again, I'm more on the medical side of it. So, that's where my focus is.
Dr. Daniel Stickler, I appreciate your time. My listeners are going to love this. If people want to reach you and want to learn more about Apeiron and Qualia, where can they reach you?
Well, the best way to reach me is at drstickler@neurohacker.com. That's the easiest way to reach me regarding the Qualia. You can also go to our website. It's apeironcenter.com. It's apeironcenter.com. It's ape iron is the easiest way to define it.
It'll all be in the show notes.
Yeah, our coaches call themselves the Iron Apes. They just kind of reverse the order of it. But if they also want to learn about the academy, they can go to apeiron.academy. There's not a .com. It's just .academy.
Wonderful. So I'm sure you'll be getting a lot of people visiting your sites. If you want to learn more about Apeiron Academy and Dr. Stickler himself, you'll find links in the show notes at benpokulski.com/podcasts. Sir, I am very, very grateful for your time. Thank you so much.
That was a lot of fun. Thanks.
Join us on benpokulski.com to learn the cutting-edge techniques to take control of your body, your brain, and create your greatest life.